This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Our first guest, James Clear, tells a compelling narrative of his own about creating little habits that ultimately led him to exactly where he wanted to be in life. Now, we often set large goals, but our systems don't lead to the realization of those goals. James has become a very sought-after speaker, and he shares his insights in his new book called Atomic Habits, an easy and proven way to build good habits and break bad ones. He says minor adjustments in habits can make huge course-changing results. He joins us to tell a few stories about how you can shift your habits one small gesture at a time. James Clear, welcome to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Hello, good to talk to you.
James, your story about the baseball bat connecting with your face is where it all starts. And this is when you're a kid. Can you quickly take us through that really amazing story and how it led to you starting to change with these very small habits?
Well, it was my sophomore year of high school, and I was hit in the face with a baseball bat. It was a very serious injury. I broke my nose, the bone behind my nose, shattered both eye sockets, suffered multiple seizures that day. I ended up not being able to breathe on my own, and ultimately was air carried to the hospital and placed into this medically induced coma overnight. And the next day, I was stable enough to be released from the coma, and the process of healing began. And it was this very long and arduous process. You know, my first physical therapy session, I was practicing walking in a straight line. I wasn't able to drive for 8 of the next 9 months. And essentially, it was a time in my life when I was forced to start small. You know, like I didn't have the option to have some radical change or flip a switch and be back to where I was before. I just had to focus on what could I do in that moment? What was something little that I could, you know, some small win that I could have from that day? And so that was the period when I first was forced to practice some of these principles. And it took me a while to make it back to the baseball field, but ultimately I was able to make it onto a college team and then ended up becoming a starter my sophomore year, captain my junior year. I was an academic All-American by the time I graduated. And I never ended up playing professionally, but I do think that I was able to accomplish something that perhaps was just as rare, which is I feel like I fulfilled my potential. I made the most of the opportunity that I had. And the way that that happened was by building these small habits, by doing things that didn't really seem impressive on any given day, you know, like going to bed at a reasonable hour or prepping for an hour before class or getting in the habit of going to the gym multiple times per week. None of these things are earth-shattering, but over the course of 3 or 5 or 7 years, it ended up making a really significant difference. And so that was the avenues for which I practiced it myself. And then now I've spent the last 5 or 6 years reading and researching and writing about those topics, both at jamesclear.com and then the last 3 years putting together Atomic Habits and ultimately releasing that.
James, many of us feel like imposters when we start off on some sort of either career or project. And that's, I kind of chuckled to myself when I read that in your book, that you started with this writing little stories about your habits, your small habits that you had developed, and you got this really quick following. It was an exponential growth of your newsletter from 2012 and until now. And you say that you were felt like you were learning alongside your readers as you were kind of honing in on what you believed were the just the essential components of, you know, changing your habits, starting with small habits. And what do you think about that process that, you know, that you were learning as you were writing and helping others?
Well, I still feel that way. You know, I view my readers and myself as peers. Like, we're just going through this together. The only difference is when I learn about something or come across a piece of research, I write about it and share it. And so I think that that's good to have my foot in the actual work, you know, to be in the thick of it, trying to build better habits, whether that's my writing habit or in the gym training, nutrition habits, things I need to do for my business and productivity habits. But that level of skin in the game is important for actually understanding what it looks like. You know, I mean, there's that famous quote that in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice there is. And I think that a lot of the time an idea can sound good. It can even be scientifically sound in the sense of a research paper, but for whatever reason, it falls flat when you try to implement it. And so it takes plenty of work to have a good opinion, to have a well-researched, well-educated thought. But at the end of the day, almost anybody can have an opinion on something. Yeah. The real thing is, do your opinions hold up when they have to be tested? And so I want to have both. I want to be in the arena working on ideas, getting knocked around, getting dirty, seeing how hard it is to implement things. And when I come across a strategy that works, I want to try to share it in a way that's easy to understand and simple to use.
James, I'm curious because we interview people who have had a personal experience that has then become transformational, and then they go on to share what they've learned. And so hearing you describe the baseball bat to the face and how it left you, and then you using your words, you were forced to practice. So the early stages, you weren't being intentional in choosing, you were forced. When did that switch flip where you were able to kind of, and I'm curious as to, did you look back and reflect upon a period of time and go, hey, I've done these little things, maybe I was forced to do them, but they have created a different system for me to work within that has been extremely beneficial? Or was there a moment in time when you said, I am going to be intentional about these little things because they're having a cumulative effect and affecting and benefiting the way I live?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, there's that famous Steve Jobs quote where he says, you can't connect the dots looking forward, only looking backward. And I think that that's true for all of our stories, certainly true of mine, that I didn't realize at the moment what I was doing. You know, like my career as an athlete and building habits in the baseball field and in the gym and so on. I was just sort of doing it, but I didn't have a language for it. I wouldn't have said, oh, I'm just trying to get 1% better today, or I'm just trying to build better habits. So that was sort of I went through it and learned implicitly, and it was only later upon reflection that I started to see that. And really it's been the last, I would say, 3 to 5 years that things have started to clarify more for me. And this is coming from someone who was very goal-oriented for a long time. You know, like I would set goals for the grades I wanted to get in school, for the weights I wanted to lift in the gym, for the revenue numbers I wanted my business to hit. And sometimes I would achieve those goals, but a lot of the time I wouldn't. And at some point I had this conversation with myself where I was like, I'm setting all these goals, but clearly that's not the thing that's making the difference, right? Like sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. So having the goal is not what makes the difference. And it was when I finally heard about and realized about this difference between systems and goals, between habits and outcomes, that I started to understand the importance of it. And then I was able to look back on the periods in my life when things went well. And I said, oh, well, that explains this. Like, look at the habit that was coming before that. Or look at the routine that I was following at practice each day. And that was the thing that was really making the difference. And so it was only upon reflection that I kind of started to put the pieces together.
Well, I love the way that you dissect goals and systems. And I've had experience with that in my life. But what I wanted to ask you about, because you just said that you found a language for it. And in your book, you repeatedly use what I would call digestible phrases or terms that I think have high impact. I love them. One of them, I'm just going to read. You have a chart and a graph on page 22, and it says, the plateau of latent potential. And and then there's this little trough between the two lines. It's called the valley of disappointment. I have to tell you, I love that kind of stuff. It just makes so much sense. And to hear that language being employed to make your point. How did you get, do you think you've always had the ability to distill things into digestible components so that people would hear it and be drawn to it as I have been?
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I don't know. I think, you know, I think to a certain degree it's a skill, right? Writing is certainly a skill. And I've, you know, I for the last 6 years, wrote a new article every Monday and Thursday and then, you know, started working on this book and so on. So there's been a lot of practice that has come with that. And for me, writing is a very iterative process. I actually don't consider myself to be a very good writer. I would say I'm a much better editor. And so the first draft, you know, like that phrase, Valley of Disappointment or Plateau of Latent Potential or some of the others that are used throughout the book, are there's no way that that came to me on the first draft. It was only by sitting and like kind of stewing on the topics and going back through it again and again and again that I toyed with different ways of phrasing it and ultimately came up with something that felt like it clicked. So I think that writing is a skill, and I still have a long way to go, but I've been able to practice that more and more recently. And so some of that, I think, shines through. I think really what you're seeing, you know, when you read Atomic Habits, you're reading it for the first time. But really what you're reading is like my 25th time of writing it. Yeah. And I think that that level of polish and ease of a reading experience hopefully is evident. And I think only comes through with that level of revision and edits.
Our guest is James Clear. His book is Atomic Habits, Tiny Changes, Remarkable Results. It's an easy and proven way to build good habits and break bad ones. James, you quote Dave Brailsford, a British cycling coach, on what he referred to as the aggregation of marginal gains. And I have to tell you, I was interviewing this very accomplished woman about, you know, What advice would you give to, you know, younger women about, you know, their careers and what has been your secret to success? And she said, making my bed every day. And she said, literally, if I get the kids to school, make my bed and get out of the house by 8:30, I feel like I've accomplished so much already. And exactly to your point and to Brailsford's point is the aggregation of marginal gains. And I'm wondering if you might relate that story about the British cycling team and how this worked for them.
So the British cycling team for many years was fairly mediocre on the world stage. They had never won the Tour de France, which is the premier race in cycling. They had won very few gold medals at the Olympics. I think they won a single one back in 1908. And this was around 2003, 2004, that they hired Dave Brailsford to come in and be their performance director. And Brailsford, as you mentioned, believed in this concept that he called the aggregation of marginal gains, which he described as the 1% improvement in nearly everything that you do. And so they made a bunch of small improvements to cycling that you might expect, like they put slightly lighter tires on the bike, they had their riders wear these electrically heated overshorts so that they could ride for longer and keep their muscles warm. They asked each rider to wear a biofeedback sensor so they could see how they would respond to training and then adjust the protocol appropriately for each individual. But there were a bunch of other cycling teams that did similar things. It was really the fact that they extended this philosophy to other areas that you wouldn't expect that made the big difference. So they, you know, they hired a surgeon to come in and teach the riders how to wash their hands to reduce the risk of getting a cold or catching the flu. They split tested different types of massage gels to see which one led to the best form of muscle recovery. They even figured out the type of pillow that led to the best night's sleep for each rider, and then they brought it on the road with them to hotels for major races and so on. And anyway, Brailsford said, you know, if we can actually do this, right, if we can execute on all these little 1% changes, then I think we could win a Tour de France in 5 years. And he ended up being wrong. They won the Tour de France in 3 years, and then they repeated again in the fourth year with a different rider. And then after 1 year off, they have won the last three in a row as well. So they've won five of the last six. But it was really at the Olympics in London in 2012 when this kind of fully came to fruition. So dozens of riders, dozens of events, men's team, women's team, British cycling team goes into the Olympics and wins 60% of the gold medals available. 4 years later in Rio, 2016, again, they won 60% of the gold medals available. And this idea that finding 1% improvements each day, looking for those small margins, those little advantages, is not just nice to have, you know, not just like a cherry on top of your performance, but actually is perhaps the master key that unlocks elite levels of success. That, I think, is a surprising notion to most people. And it's further indication that habits are the compound interest of self-improvement. They're these little choices that don't seem like much on any given day, but the same way that money multiplies through compound interest, the effects of your habits multiply as you repeat them across time. And so a lot of the game of getting the results that you want, of improving your ability, no matter what the domain is really about waking up each morning with that philosophy of how can I get 1% better each day? How can I do something slightly better today? And if you're willing to do that, then you find those opportunities for improvement everywhere, and you turn around a year or two later, and your habits have taken you to a very remarkable destination.
I love that, the compound interest of self-improvement. About, I think it was 6 or 8 years ago that Charles Duhigg came out with The Power of Habit. That was a really popular book. And you sort of talk about his approach and then yours and your four-step model of habits, cue, craving, response, and reward. What are the sort of the differences between the two approaches?
Yeah, so the main difference is just the second stage, which is craving. And so I felt like it was essential to add that stage to clarify what is really going on when you build a habit. And I also had just some, I consider, kind of fundamental questions about how a habit works, or, like, for example, why do different people respond to the same cue in different ways? You know, like, if you walk into a room and you see a pack of cigarettes on the counter, one person who's a smoker might look at that pack of cigarettes and they have the craving, the urge to smoke. The other person looks at it and it doesn't mean anything. They don't find themselves feeling the urge to smoke. So what explains that? Why is that the case? Because if it was just a cue and that led straight to the routine, well then, cue, you see the cigarettes, you should be picking one up and smoking it no matter what. And so the second stage, the craving, is really about prediction. It's really about the anticipation that comes before the action. It's about how you interpret the cues in your life. And that interpretation plays a really significant role in how you act and what habits you form. And it explains why someone who is a smoker feels this craving. They predict it's positive to pick up the cigarette and smoke it, that there will be some benefit to doing it, whether it's reducing nerves or getting to smoke with a friend or so on. And another person looks at it and predicts, oh, those are just cigarettes, I don't want to smoke one at all. And so that is the primary difference. And I think Duhigg wrote a great book. It's a very behavioral psychology approach in that book, where he talks about conditioning habits through cues and rewards and so on. And there's been a lot of research that has shown that that's very useful, and that's why I included it as part of my model as well. But in the last 50 years, there has been a huge wave of cognitive psychology as well that talks about how your moods and emotions and feelings impact your habits. And so the second stage of my model is intended to address some of those concerns as well. You know, like, how you're feeling in the moment changes what type of habit or action you take. If you walk into a kitchen and you see a loaf of bread in the morning and you haven't eaten yet, then you interpret that cue as, oh, I should make some toast, it's time for breakfast. But 20 minutes later, if you walk back into the kitchen and see a loaf of bread again, now you're full. So your state has changed, your feeling has changed. And because your state has changed, you don't get the same craving, even though the cue is the same. And so I think that the four-step model explains some of those nuances and differences a little more clearly, and hopefully gives us a toolkit that we need to change our habits in an effective way.
I love this book, James. It's so great. I'm so glad you could join us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Atomic Habits. I've already changed my habits, I have to tell you, in the last 2 days since I picked up this book. It's a great thing. So it's an easy and proven way to build good habits and break bad ones. Tiny changes, remarkable results. James Clear, Thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, yes. And I am so amazed. Perhaps it was because of time, our short amount of time, that you did not bring up the habit extraordinaire.
I was getting there.
Which is the glowing green smoothie. I said it first, so you didn't get to.
Right. And I started, I think, 6 years ago now. And I didn't have, this is the interesting part for me, is that difference between a desired outcome and a goal. Mm-hmm. I think, as James states in his book, goals can be somewhat counterproductive because you set a goal, you reach that goal, and then it all goes away because you've achieved whatever it is you set out to do. And to use my green glowing smoothie as an example, we got this off of an interview mm-hmm. that we did with Kimberly Snyder, and I said, that sounds interesting, and she recommended that this become my breakfast routine. So there's more of a habit that she was recommending, a routine that she was recommending, and I didn't say, I'm going to drink this thing for a month. I didn't say I was going to drink it for a year. I said, sounds interesting. I'll give it a shot and see where it goes. So what I have found on reflection, like James reflecting on his habits, is that it has had all sorts of unintended benefits and consequences that have all been positive, which reinforce the habit. And there I find myself 6 years later without any goal except to make one each morning. And that's that 1%. Every morning, I try to make a GGS. Most of the mornings, I make one. Every now and then, I miss. And it's no big deal. And here I am 6 years later still drinking this thing.
Well, maybe it is the not punishing yourself for when you don't have it that...
That's part of it.
That creates the desire to continue to do it. There's no self-beat up.
I think that's part of it, yeah.